Welcome to Soundbites on Domrava. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. In the past year, we've brought you stories about the land, the farms, and the people of Domrava. Throughout the year, it became clear to us that our listeners want to see the rural character of Domrava survive. So we began to look deeper into certain questions. What will it take to keep farmers on their land? Is it possible to tend to the health of the environment and also to the needs of the people of our state and our nation? We will explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we can get there together. This week on Soundbites on Domrava, we recognize the 40th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. We discuss its legacy and the challenges that still remain for our future. We also bring you an update from inside the courthouse of the Waterkeeper Purdue Hudson trial in the second half of the hour. Because this trial, regardless of its outcome, will mean some very significant changes and set serious precedents for agriculture, pollution, and our waterways. The 40th anniversary of the Clean Water Act was last week. We start now with a roundtable discussion tackling what this act has meant over the past four decades and what it might mean for our future. We also discuss what really pollutes our waterways and whether or not different forms of agriculture, big, small, organic, or industrial, have truly different effects on pollution in our waterways. Joining us are David Curry, Outreach Associate at the Property and Environment Research Center, Joan Mulhern, Senior Legislative Counsel at Earth Justice, a nonprofit environmental law organization, and Alan Girard, Eastern Shore Director for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, whose commentary on the Clean Water Act we start with for this roundtable discussion.
This is really a critical moment in time for the Chesapeake Bay, for the waters that drain to it, and really for the waters of the nation. You know, the Clean Water Act, passed by a Republican administration in 1972, you know, is really the framework for helping clean up polluted rivers, streams, estuaries throughout the country. The Act calls for pollution limits to be established in waters that are found to be impaired, and it requires jurisdictions, states, to address those impairments with plans. It's all in the Act. And, you know, we see here at the 40th anniversary in the Chesapeake Bay region that there's significant progress that's being made, you know, as a result of this work. We do have a pollution limit established for the main pollutants in the bay, nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment. And the bay jurisdictions, the six states that drain to the Chesapeake, do have what we call watershed implementation plans, really a blueprint to get this Chesapeake Bay off the federal dirty waters list.
David Curry, your sense of these last 40 years.
The Clean Water Act has served as a framework for how we clean up our waterways. And how I view the act is that it doesn't allow for enough flexibility for entrepreneurs and for more private entities to clean up the bay or other waterways. And I can talk about some examples where the EPA has started to work with private organizations and made some progress there as well.
And Joe Mulhern.
I think we've kind of really lost sight of the goal of eliminating water pollution. And that's really what was fundamental to the Clean Water Act when it was passed 40 years ago. And really a goal that the nation can and should embrace for all of our rivers and streams and estuaries.
I mean, when this started out, I mean, the Clean Water Act, it was focusing not so much on farms, but was focusing on sewer systems and runoff like that.
The Clean Water Act actually had a partial exemption for agriculture and looked at several of the other sectors that do pollute water, including centralized wastewater treatment, urban and suburban stormwater runoff, and sources of that nature.
So I'm curious, as you know, and we all know that the Clean Water Act, one of the emotional things that grabbed the nation in the late 60s and early 70s was when the Cuyahoga River and other rivers caught on fire in America. And that kind of grabbed people's consciousness. And even when President Nixon vetoed the bill, a bipartisan group of Republican and Democratic senators overturned his veto, which allowed for this act to take place. You raised some issues a moment, David Curry. Talk a bit more about what you were saying.
I think some of the strengths of the Clean Water Act has specifically been in regulating kind of urbanized or point source pollution, pollution that you can literally trace back to a pipe. As far as non-point source pollution is concerned, it seems that the Clean Water Act really isn't suited very well for dealing with that strictly on a command and control basis.
While I appreciate that there are creative means of trying to address especially certain non-point sources of pollution, trading is basically trading one source of pollution for another and allowing certain dischargers to continue to pollute our waters if they sort of buy off some credit from other polluters.
One question that I would have is just how can we, you know, achieve a zero pollution standard? That's my real concern. And so I try to look for kind of how can we improve the situation we're in? And I think we can do that through trade. I don't really see the zero pollution outcome, but I do see a reduction in pollution, which I think is very optimistic, and even maybe a cheaper way of reducing pollution.
I think that's a good point, you know, and Mark, you asked about, you know, the effectiveness of the Act, and, you know, the Act doesn't say, you know, we need to arrive at zero pollution. We need to arrive at a level that achieves water quality standards. That's what the pollution limit in the Chesapeake Bay is all about. It's not 0 pounds of nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment we want to have run off the land and come from point sources. We need to allow some pollution to come in, but, you know, not so much that we're exceeding the healthy limit for the bay. So the question is, how can we best manage the costs of those of dealing with those impact in a way that's going to be most cost effective? You know, requiring us to eliminate from pollution from all sources, you know, may not be a realistic goal.
That goal is actually in the Clean Water Act. It's an aspirational goal. It's not enforceable, but it was the intent of the authors of the Clean Water Act that we would stop using our rivers, lakes, streams, wetlands, and estuaries as dumping grounds for pollution.
And I agree that the Clean Water Act's initial goal was to eliminate all discharges into the nation's rivers and streams, but I think that goal was also set to occur by 1985, and then the act was amended after that, I believe, to be a little more realistic, focusing on reductions rather than pure elimination.
I just feel like we've gotten so far away from that that now many people look at the Clean Water Act as a law to issue permits to allow pollution when the initial goal was to eliminate water pollution.
I mean, when you look at the grade that was given the Chesapeake Bay in the last study that came out a year or so ago, it was pretty dismal. It's the question is, what are we celebrating and what are we talking about has to happen? I mean, we have all these discussions now about point source pollution, explosion of development, and our way of living in highways and chem lawns and the rest, as well as what comes off of farms, because farmers are always bearing the brunt of this debate. What should be the next 40 years?
Well, you know, my take on the state of the water, the first part of your question, you know, the Bay Foundation puts out a report every 2 years,
right.
Every 2 years now, you know, called the state of our bay. The last one out in 2010 puts the bay at a 31 on a scale of 0 to 100.
Right.
And, you know, 100 is back in Captain John Smith's time, you know, when he sailed the Chesapeake and we only had a few hundred thousand Native Americans living in the watershed. You know, we're upwards of 16 million people now. Getting to 100 is probably not a realistic goal. The Bay Foundation actually has an organizational goal to get us to 70 by 2050. Now, you know, this 31 number, in 1983, we estimate it to be at around a 23. So there has progress been made. We've primarily seen that progress come from both the agricultural sector and the wastewater treatment sector. You know, in Maryland, and now we're seeing in other Bay states, ratepayers have, in partnership with the General Assembly, agreed to invest in upgrading our largest wastewater treatment plant. You know, we see right here in Easton, where I'm calling from now, the plant here was one of the first in the state to employ this technology, and we've seen massive gains in pollution reduction as a result of that. Farmers have put in place best management practices, cover crops, filter strips along streams and rivers. All of these are making a difference. There's absolutely more that needs to get done. And, you know, the Clean Water Act, it does help us provide this blueprint to help us get there. But we have seen some progress.
I agree with that. We definitely have seen progress due to the Clean Water Act. And it has dramatically improved water quality in many water bodies around the country. But for the last decade or so, the Chesapeake Bay has improved. Other water bodies have stayed the same. For the last decade, water quality has become kind of a stagnant goal, I guess. I mean, about 45% of the nation's waters are still not safe for fishing or swimming or other uses. And we've been kind of stuck in that rut for a while. We've had improvements, but we've stalled out over the last 10 years.
Yeah, that stalling out analogy is right on, and it's something that the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, where I work, had a lot of concern with and has continued to have concern with. You know, back in 2008, we, particularly when the EPA and the federal government announced it, noted that, our foot has been off the accelerator on this bay cleanup effort. There was a commitment to make major reductions in pollution to the bay by 2010. EPA came out and the Bay Program came out and said that we weren't going to meet that goal. And, we challenged the federal government in court and said, you know, that the Clean Water Act actually requires progress, and we haven't seen the progress. In fact, you're reporting that you're not making it. And so accelerating progress is absolutely essential. And in the settlement agreement that we reached with the EPA, we actually included not let's just set a goal 10 or 15 years down the road for implementing a suite of practices, but let's make sure that we are monitoring progress towards achieving that goal over time. And so you have what's come to be known as these two-year milestones. How are we doing in two-year increments to evaluate the progress of implementing practices that are going to keep waters clean and healthy that drain to the Chesapeake? There's clearly more work that needs to be done, but, you know, when you bite it off in these two-year increments and you recognize that, look, we've got 13 years to 2025, that really helps people sort of be able to take bite-sized chunks out of this work and not have it be overwhelming, not, you know, look a couple years away from your goal and say, gosh, we aren't really going
to
make it.
So before I come back to the why we haven't made it and what your ideas were, Alan, David, we haven't heard from you in this part of our conversation.
I agree that the progress has certainly slowed down. And I think that is in part due to the type of pollution that's easy to control with command and control regulation like the Clean Water Act versus pollution that's not so easy to control with that type of regulation. And so I think that we've seen a lot of the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, from this act. And we're coming into a new generation of how we need to approach pollution in our country. I'm not sure that the same approach is going to be effective for such a dispersed type of pollution. And so I think we really need to consider that. And another thing we need to consider is that these solutions for farmers are not at zero cost. I think there's some really interesting techniques that can be used, especially like Alan was mentioning, the riparian buffers, where you can plant different types of shrubs that filter out sediment, nutrients, and pesticides before it gets into the water. Those are really interesting things, but we have to think about how can we incentivize farmers to take this step.
Yeah, this is Alan again.
Yeah.
I think you're right, David, that the question about encouraging implementation is really key. Certainly regulations have a role to play. I know the Bay Foundation has been very involved in Washington to ensure that you know, the voluntary incentive-based programs that farmers throughout Maryland and the Bay watershed have really endorsed can move forward at providing the resources that farmers need to get the job done. These are taxpayer dollars, but they go to ensure that food is grown in a way that really minimizes impacts to water quality. It's a public benefit.
Well, you know, when we look at what you described earlier, Alan Girard, as what you would like to see the Chesapeake Bay Foundation happen by 2050, the 75% cleaner, getting a grade of at least 75%, 100% being what happened just as the Europeans got here. I wonder, starting with Joan, I mean, people are always having this argument. I mean, what is important for our future? And is the idea of clean water, given the kind of human development we have, the kind of industrial agriculture we have, the amount of sewage plants that exist, I think some 50-some thousand in the Chesapeake Bay water region itself, 500, large public industrial wastewater treatment plants in this Chesapeake Bay region watershed. And how you balance that out, and what is important? Is it the clean waterways? Are clean waterways antithetical to economic development? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, this is going at the crux of it. How you begin to tackle this, Joan?
Well, we asked that question. You know, what is important to people when it comes to the Chesapeake Bay? You know, what people said is, we want healthy water, you know, for our children, for our grandchildren. You know, the crabs and the oysters here are iconic species, not only from an economic perspective, you know, the waterman community, the ecotourism and the restaurants and all of those industries that rely on clean and healthy water. There's an economic value there. There's an aesthetic value. There's a cultural history value, you know, particularly on the Eastern Shore. This is people's heritage that's at stake here, and we didn't want to presume that all of that was sort of packed into this idea of clean water, and we really were deliberate at asking the public, you know, what is the value here to you, and it really is this idea of, you know, multi-generational. We need to be doing this for our future. You know, the Native Americans talk about planning for the seventh generation. Well, we're going to try and plan for 2025. We're going to do what we can, and put the measures in place. And that really means rolling up your sleeves and committing to take action. And that's why the goal is important. A specific number, you know, a healthy level for water quality in the Bay is important. And you know, the framework of the Clean Water Act is making it possible for not just, you know, the EPA and the six Bay states to, put these blueprints in place to have us make progress, but all the way down to the city and town level. I attend a lot of meetings in Talbot County, Queen Anne's County on Maryland's Eastern Shore. Those government leaders, elected officials, agency staff, you know, private sector partners from the agriculture sector, from the building industry, they're coming together and talking about these issues in ways that we haven't seen in recent years. And they're talking about cost-effective, practical solutions to getting the job done. And I got to tell you, you know, it's really spurring some incredible conversations, some incredible innovative new ideas to try and reduce cost, make sure that implementation is practical and doable. I'm really encouraged by it because we just haven't seen this level of energy from all the players in this work coming to bear on addressing this problem.
One of the players that and I agree with all the values that you just outlined, and the public health value of clean water is also extremely important to us, to all of us. DC WASA, the Water and Sewage Authority, is currently trying to put off by a decade the time by which they have to end the discharge of raw sewage into the Potomac and Anacostia rivers.
Because they say it costs too much money?
Currently it's about 3 billion gallons a year.
And what's their reason?
And while that gets dissipated as it flows into the Chesapeake Bay, which it does, it makes it so that the Potomac and Anacostia rivers will make you sick. And so we are seeing progress, and there are players who are definitely participating in a positive way towards cleaning up the region's waters. But I have to say, it's not everyone, because D.C. WASA is trying to put off by a decade their requirements to end discharges of raw sewage into our rivers.
So what you're describing, though, Joan, what I was trying to ask as you were describing it, is that there to me lies the crux of the problem. I mean, it seems to me that part of the issue of what you face in the Clean Water Act, what you face in general when it comes to questions about our waterways and their well-being and what they mean to keeping kept clean is money. I'm sure that one of the things D.C. is saying is they don't have the money to fix the plant. They can't upgrade the plant unless they cut something else. So the question
that's exactly right. It's not that we don't know in the 21st century how to take raw sewage out of our waterways. It's a question of who's going to pay for it. And they were given 20 years, and they've sat on their hands for half of it.
So if that's the case, and maybe go around Ramadan here before we conclude our conversation in just a little bit, David, and then come on in, Alan, and come back to Joan. Then what is the solution? I mean, if part of this has to do with nobody's enforcing anything in the last 20 years, or enforcing it in a lax way, not in a more stringent way, and we don't have money in our public sector for infrastructure or money to ensure that we can end runoff from farms or to end development in certain areas. Some people would argue that's not the right way to do it. Then how do we do it? I mean, you were saying earlier, David, about this the trading, like as in people talking about carbon trading. But most studies have shown that doesn't really end the pollution. That just puts off the pollution or allows one person to pollute and another while another doesn't.
I completely agree with you on that. And I think that one of the big obstacles is the regulatory structure and how we can induce a little more flexibility into that to encourage the connection between the rewards of clean water and the cost of doing so. And I think that we need to try to induce, you know, cooperation, innovation, and accountability. And the question of how to do that is very complicated, and I don't claim to have an answer there. What I do think, though, is that if we can connect these environmental issues to more market-specific mechanisms, I think we run a greater chance of achieving water quality. The trick in that is that we have to be able to connect different types of discharges to those that are doing it. And then there's also ways that, like I mentioned before, that farmers can take a very active role. And when they're providing this economic good, which is clean water, we need to figure out a way to encourage that. And I think in a market system with strong property rights and a strong legal infrastructure, a strong judicial legal infrastructure, that's very, very possible.
And Alan, so take your stab at that.
Well, to me, it's clear, you know, when we talk about the Chesapeake Clean Water Blueprint, what we're talking about is essentially, you know, a set of requirements, a set of potential incentives, monetary incentives, resources to help get the job done, you know, and encouraging people to take their own personal responsibility, you know, sort of outside of the government system. You know, that's really the three-legged stool here. What the blueprint does is it helps put together a framework for that, so that we can know when actions are taken at each of those levels, that we can, again, you know, monitor the progress over time and ensure that we get to the goal. We have known for years, if not decades, you know, what the problems in the Bay are, what their sources are, what's required to address those problems and you know, have them fixed. You know, and the science tells us that. Where we need to be going is to ensure that the political will is there. You know, elected representatives who represent the interests of the public make the decisions that need to be made to either regulate or provide sufficient incentive to make sure that we're pointed in the right direction. And this is, you know, this is part of what's being challenged now in federal court. You know, is and Mark, you brought this up earlier in the program. Back in the 70s, when we had rivers catching on fire, you know, we argue that one of the problems was that there was not a coordinated, consistent approach to dealing with water pollution that has sources from multiple jurisdictions. What we have going right now with the blueprint in the Chesapeake Bay is we have six states, all the jurisdictions therein, working cooperatively to get the bay off the federal dirty waters list. You know, there's a deliberate approach to making sure that cooperation exceeds. It's important that that cooperation is maintained because we know when we didn't have it, we had some real problems with healthy water in the past.
Well, finally, just looking at the next 40 years, and we'll conclude here. And Joan, one of the things I was thinking about is, as Alan was describing the what's going on in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, is that states are doing different things. If you look at Maryland, we're still not where we should be, but they're moving in a strong way as opposed to Pennsylvania and Virginia, which is sometimes very recalcitrant to curtail pollution. So that's part of the problem. The question is, so how do we get to that point where rivers are livable and people are also working?
Well, I think we can get there, and I think that part of it is the strong, overwhelmingly bipartisan support for clean water. It is usually mostly a matter of money because we know how technologically to keep pollution out of water. And, you know, on the 40th anniversary of the Clean Water Act, I like to look back on one of my favorite quotes of one of the authors of the Clean Water Act, Ed Muskie of Maine, who said, "Can we afford clean water? Can we afford rivers and lakes and streams and oceans, which continue to make possible life on this planet? Can we afford life itself?" And I think that's a really telling quote because clean water is necessary to life. It's not possible for us to live on this planet without clean water. So can we afford it? We better be able to because we can't afford to live without it.
That was Joan Mulhern, Senior Legislative Counsel at Earth Justice. David Curry, Outreach Associate at the Property and Environment Research Center, and Alan Girard, Eastern Shore Director for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. We're about to take a very short break, but please don't go away. We have an update on the Waterkeeper Purdue Hudson trial in just a few minutes. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, your host for Soundbites on Delmarva. The Waterkeeper Purdue Hudson trial in federal court, taking place right now in Baltimore, is something we really all should be aware of because it will set huge precedents for agriculture and also affect laws around pollution and our waterways throughout the United States of America. Furthermore, this case will set the precedent about whether or not poultry giant Purdue can be held responsible for pollution caused by those who raise its chickens. Many have said that this trial could drastically change the chicken industry on the Eastern Shore. And we turn to two perspectives from people who have been watching this trial unfold. We first hear from Scott Edwards, co-director of Food and Water Watch Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. So, Scott, let's see what how you've been following this trial and at Food and Water Watch, and what have been the kind of highlights of the last week and what our listeners may have missed.
I think that what we've seen a lot of evidence, we've seen a lot of testimony, And I think from our perspective at Food and Water Watch, what's clear is that the central issue in this case, and that is, did the chicken operations at the farm contribute to the pollution? That central issue is becoming clearer and clearer, I think. And in a minute, I'll tell you about some testimony that I think really puts the icing on the cake on that issue. But what we're seeing is typical trial work. Both parties are out there putting on everything they have, and the judge is taking it all in and listening to all the witnesses, all the testimony, and it's going to be his job at the end of the day to weigh it all out and see where he's at. But there are some things that are undeniable, and that is that there is pollution found in the ditches leaving that farm. MD, I mean, that's been confirmed. The water is making its way down the Franklin Branch and out, and that's fairly much been confirmed. I mean, the remaining issue that everybody's hanging their hat on, at least the defendants are, is whether these chicken house operations are contributing to the pollution. That's from our perspective, the big issue here.
So what was, before I come back to that last point you just made,
sure,
about the chicken house, what was the testimony that you found so ringing and so powerful this week?
Well, it goes to that point. And that is the testimony of Alan Hudson himself. There's a tiny little bit of a backgrounder needed for this, and that is that on the issue of nutrient management plans. And so these CAFOs, all farms down in Maryland, are subject to control through these comprehensive nutrient management plans. And I don't know if your readers are familiar with those plans, but those are basically waste management plans. And what's supposed to happen with a comprehensive nutrient management plan is an engineer, somebody who's been trained to assess farms, comes down to the farm, independent assessment of the farm, to identify all the potential sources of pollution, and come up with ways to either eliminate them or reduce them so that there isn't pollution coming off of these farms anymore. And those CNMPs are submitted to state agencies for approval, and that's how we're supposed to control our farms. They're these comprehensive nutrient management plans, objective, science-based plans to cut out pollution from farms. The Hudsons have been working on their comprehensive nutrient management plan for the last year or so, getting it ready to submit to the Maryland Department of the Environment for approval so that his farm is running in a nice, clean manner that all farms should be running. But it turns out that Alan Hudson testified last Thursday afternoon that his CNMP, he was given a draft of it by the nutrient management plan writer, again, who's independent, who, by the way, is also paid for with taxpayers' dollars. Alan Hudson testified that it was $4,900 worth of taxpayers' dollars went to pay this objective, independent, comprehensive nutrient management plan writer. So back in February, Alan Hudson got a copy of that and told the plan writer that he'd have to send it to his lawyers for comment. And so he did that. And then Mr. Hudson testified that he contacted the writer of the plan and had the writer of the plan take out several recommendations to reduce pollution from the farm. And those recommendations were recommendations that this plan writer felt were necessary to eliminate pollution from the chicken houses. So, for example, in the plan was a recommendation that Mr. Hudson plant a tree buffer alongside the chicken houses to keep pollution out of the ditches. Mr. Hudson had that taken out. He suggested that he fill in ditch number 3, which runs alongside the chicken houses, and put a pipe in instead so that the pollution from the chicken houses wouldn't land in that ditch and contribute to the pollution that's found by MDE in those ditches. Mr. Hudson had him take that reference out. In short, he had every reference to pollution coming from the chicken houses taken out of the comprehensive nutrient management plan. And then this comprehensive nutrient plan was finalized and sent into MDE just a couple of months ago as their final plan. So this is not a plan written by some objective engineer who's out there to reduce pollution. This is a plan that's being written by people who want to cover up sources of pollution.
But this, now the plan, the way I, and I was reading part of that transcript myself that was on Michelle Merkel's blog, that, I mean, it's not a common practice that farmers run their plans past a consultant or a lawyer. They usually write them themselves and put them in.
You would hope that that's the way these things are done. I understand, you know, perhaps they send drafts off to their client. Their client is the farmer, even though they're paid with through taxpayers' dollars. I expect that, that these plans are sent off to clients for review. I hope it's not standard practice that those clients and or their lawyers then get to rewrite these plans, because if it is, then not only is this CNMP completely defective, but our entire comprehensive nutrient management plan system in the state of Maryland is just a complete sham. If you've got the people who are responsible for these sources of pollution actually writing the plans that are supposed to remedy these problems, then we might as well throw our hands up in the air at this point if we're going to try to clean up industrial ag operations on the Eastern Shore of Maryland.
I mean, there's a lot of public sympathy for the Hudsons as moderately small farmers in the Eastern Shore.
Sure.
That's a big piece of this, and at least in the public eye. But in the larger part of this trial, it seems to me, at least those of you who brought the suit in the first place, it's about the culpability or responsibility of Purdue. Now, that hasn't really come up in the trial yet, has it?
There's been a lot of testimony about how deeply Purdue controls these operations. So there have been Purdue employees who have testified about their day-to-day operation of this facility. There's been and that was the flock supervisor specifically, but there have been other Purdue employees that talk generally about their control, their standards, their ability under the contracts. For example, in the growers' contracts that Purdue has in place for all their contract growers, including the Hudsons, it's standard language that if for whatever reason Purdue doesn't want the grower growing for them anymore, if the grower is not adhering to their standards and practices and not following their directions, that Purdue can just terminate the contract right in the whenever at will, just terminate the contract. And if they happen to terminate it while there's a flock on that farm, Purdue doesn't come and get its birds. Purdue continues to raise that flock on that farm without the grower's permission. They walk in, they run that farm, even with a terminated contract, until that flock reaches the age of maturity, and then they come and collect their birds. So there's been a lot of testimony about Purdue's control. And so that's, I think, again, from our perspective, and this is ultimately for the judge to decide, of course, from our perspective, that's been pretty well established that Purdue's running these farms.
So what is on do you know what's on tap for this coming week in this trial?
So there's additional testimony. Defendants are continuing to put on some of their witnesses today and into tomorrow, certainly. That testimony may end tomorrow. It might go into Wednesday, but I think certainly at the latest you'll see, barring any unexpected issues, you'll see the close of testimony either tomorrow or first thing Wednesday, I think at the latest. And then there will be closing arguments made by both sides, and sometimes courts want to hear closing arguments the next day. Sometimes they tell lawyers just to jump right in and do their closing arguments right there. And then I think you can, again, barring any unforeseen circumstances, I think you can safely say that by Thursday this trial will be over, unless something happens to change that.
And when the testimony ends, how long is it until the judge renders his decision?
There's no formula, judges can rule right off the bench, right there. It happens, not typically in a case as complex with this much evidence. You expect a judge not to rule off the bench. You'd expect him to go back in and examine all the evidence and read through all the transcripts and think about the law and the facts and then issue a decision. And that could be months. That could be 2 months, 3 months. There's no limitation on when the judge decides. But typically within a couple of months after the close of the trial, you would expect to see a decision.
Well, it's a complex and complicated trial. It's going into its second week here, and it looks like it may take all of close to 2 weeks to wrap up.
That's Timothy B. Wheeler, environmental reporter for the Baltimore Sun, who's also been following the trial. As we continue our look at the trial taking place that involves the Purdue Company and the Hudson Farm brought by the water keepers in federal court here in Baltimore. So you've been covering this trial, and I'm, and we've heard from lots of different people about their analysis of what's going on. And I'm curious, just from your perch, what you see and what you've seen in the last couple of days. I know that you have a blog that came out this week where one of the things you were writing about was this guy Charles Hagedorn, who is a microbiology professor from Virginia Tech, talking about whether or not this was cow fecal matter or chicken fecal matter. But so tell me what you've discovered.
The waterkeeper's case, which was presented largely last week, was hinged in large part on evidence of contamination in the drainage ditches leading away from the farm, and on an expert witness that they presented, who argued that it was clear that the poultry houses had contributed to the contamination in that ditch, if not been a main source of it. The defense began putting on its case late last week and continues into this week. And Monday, expert witness for Purdue testified, Professor Charles Hagedorn from Virginia Tech, who presented a different argument for where the pollution came from. And there seems to be at this point no dispute that the ditch, drainage ditch, was badly polluted. It had very high levels of fecal coliform and E. coli bacteria and nutrients likely associated with manure, animal manure. But Professor Hagedorn said it was the small herd of cattle on the Hudson's farm and not the 80,000 Cornish hens they were raising that was the, in his judgment anyway, was the sole source of that pollution. There were something like 40 adult cows and around 20 calves being raised there, and they are allowed to roam freely. Water near the top of one of those drainage ditches. As I said, it's a complicated case. It's a little bit of a detective story in terms of trying to track it down. There are charges and countercharges on both sides, and it's basically going to be up to a judge to sort out whether the Waterkeeper Alliance has met its burden of proof that the pollution in the ditches came from the poultry operation. One of the sort of ironies here, in a way, is if they conclude that if he concludes that the pollution came from the cows and not the chickens, the farmer and Purdue are both they win the lawsuit, they're exonerated, but the pollution itself, at least until recently, was essentially unregulated. Apparently,
that's interesting. I mean, you sound like the two were kind of shocked by that.
Well, it is kind of striking. I did actually went up to Secretary Hance during break in the trial and asked him what he thought of that. He initially sort of said, well, this lawsuit is all about the chickens. But I sort of pressed him on it, and he said, well, we have the Department of Agriculture has stepped in and helped taken steps to help the Hudsons deal with that. And I asked by getting their cows perhaps away from the ditch, and I asked him if that was a good situation, from the standpoint of the Chesapeake Bay. His sort of initial reaction was that that's the Department of Environment's job to sort of determine what's polluting waters and to take action, and their action in this case was in essence not to find any source for that pollution. But he did say, after I asked him about it, that there were, the department recently did adopt regulations that require farmers in Maryland to take steps to keep their livestock away from water and to ensure that reduce the opportunities for manure on farms to from animals to wash into streams in the bay. Those regulations, it may be remembered, were vehemently opposed by farmers and the Maryland Farm Bureau, who argued they were costly and would take away valuable land from farmers, and that they were unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
But the department, after making some adjustments and some compromises, did go forward with them, just recently finalized them.
Two thoughts popped in my head as you were describing that. One is that, I mean, this is key to the trial. If the judge thinks that these whatever polluted the water around the Hudson Farm was in fact not from chickens, it would let Perdue off the hook. Perdue would not be liable then. If that was the case, I think the major part of the suit would have been lost in terms of the waterkeeper's perspective.
Well, it would, yes. Basically, you know, it's a sort of a two-step case here. Was there pollution? I guess nobody's disputing that at this point. And then the question is, where did it come from? If it came from the chickens, then, you know, is Perdue, that you know, would essentially mean that the judge would find against the Hudsons. And then the question would be, the other piece of this case that's hotly contested is whether Perdue actually controlled how the Hudsons raised those chickens, which are in fact Perdue chickens or Cornish hens, whether they exerted so much control over the Hudsons that they, in effect, were jointly responsible for the pollution. And if the judge finds, in essence, that there's not evidence or not sufficient evidence that the chickens were a source of the pollution, then yes, both would be off the hook, as you say, and the waterkeepers would have lost. There's the waterkeepers' argument. They're not denying or disputing the notion that the cows were polluting the ditch, but they're saying that you know, if even some of that pollution in the ditch came from the chickens, and they contend it did, then that's a violation, and that the judge has to rule in their favor.
So this is fascinating. So to see where this might go, I mean, so what was Jane Barrett, who is the attorney with the University of Maryland Environmental Law Clinic, who is the lead attorney in this case at the moment? How did she question that about the was our questioning effective from your perspective or not effective when it came to challenging Hagedorn's findings?
Well, these witness testimony like this is a protracted matter.
Right.
I wasn't present for the entire testimony and cross examination, but one of the first things that she did, as the attorneys for Perdue and the Hudsons attempted to do with the waterkeepers' witness, is to sort of draw as tight a boundary as possible around what they can claim to be experts on, and to say both sides sort of said essentially that neither one did any extensive testing to determine where this contamination was coming from, and that is true. Basically, the Department of the Environment investigated this case, and neither expert acknowledged, both experts for both sides acknowledged that they hadn't done any of their own testing. They relied on essentially the documents that were a matter of public record, or that had preceded the lawsuit. Her cross-examination of Professor Hagedorn attempted to to draw him out and to make the case that it was possible to get him to acknowledge that the fans, in particular, on the chicken houses could have blown enough poultry litter out of the chicken houses and deposited them on the ground outside that could have washed into the ditch through the drainage swale and the pipe that the Hudsons installed to draw rainwater away from their chicken houses.
So I'm curious what you've been following this for a long time, these issues for a long time. From what do you think the importance of this trial is? And this is more than just a lawsuit to find out whether or not the Hudson family in fact polluted the waters around their farm, whether it came from their chickens, which is what the plaintiffs would like, or from their cows.
Mm-hmm.
This goes to the heart of responsibility in terms of the relationship between larger companies and farmers who raise animals for them. So, I mean, this is a very critical trial. How do you see it?
Well, it clearly would change the status quo if the waterkeepers won, because the system now essentially leaves the manure in the hands of the farmer who's raising the birds under contract for Perdue or Mount Air and any other poultry integrators or poultry companies. The companies own the birds. They supply the farmers with the birds. They supply them with the feed, and they tell them how much to feed them and how to handle them and everything else. And they take possession of the birds once they're raised to market size and leave the manure with the farmer. In up to this point, the contention has been that the farmers want that manure, that it's an asset. It's a you know, a form of fertilizer that they would otherwise have to pay dearly for if they had to go to the feed store to get it, and that they can use it on their crops to grow crops. Some farmers do not have crops, and therefore they sell that manure to neighbors or to others for use. But the issue would be, in essence, that if Purdue was held liable or jointly liable here, then that would essentially force the poultry companies to take a much greater role in how that manure is handled.
So, and you'll be covering this trial. I guess you'll be watching this over the next week. This should be closing this week, correct?
That's possible. I mean, the last word I heard was that they may wrap up by Thursday or Friday.
Has anything come out of this for you that you did not expect?
Well, I think it you know, provides a window into this business of how farms are monitored and regulated in Maryland. Much of the oversight of farms in Maryland is essentially not accessible to the public. The nutrient management plans, the documents by which farmers are required to keep track of how much fertilizer they produce and use on their farms, those documents are private, are sealed, are not public, because under Maryland law, this was essentially a political compromise that was adopted back in the late 90s when Maryland first began requiring farmers to operate according to a plan. Now, the state departments of agriculture and the environment have regulators who get to see those plans and visit the farms, but the documents generally specific to any particular farm are not available for the public to see. So you essentially have to trust that the state's taking care of business.
Well, Tim, I trust and hope that you will join us once this trial is over for some post-decision analysis.
Okay.
We'd love to have that.
Sure.
Tim Wheeler is covers the environment in the Chesapeake Bay for the Baltimore Sun. Has been on this beat for a while and really knows it back and forth. And, Tim, thanks so much for the work you do, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark.
We thank Scott Edwards and Timothy Wheeler for those updates on the Waterkeeper Purdue-Hudson trial, and we will continue to follow this through its conclusion. We spoke with the folks from Purdue. They're not commenting on the trial until after it is over, but then we'll be happy to come on and join us. We attempted to call Bill Satterfield, who is the head of the Delmarva Poultry Industry, Inc., but couldn't get through to him this week. I'm sure he'll join us again in the future. And the Maryland Farm Bureau, which could not find anybody for this broadcast, but again, I'm sure will join us on future broadcasts. And I'd like to thank our guests from the first half hour of our program, David Curry, Joe Mulhern, and Alan Girard. I should also mention our new Facebook page for this program, which we'll be updating with podcasts, photos from our site visits, stories, and news that you'll find interesting. Like our page at facebook.com/soundbitesradio, or you can just search Soundbites, Exploring the Future of Our Food System. And thank you for joining us once again. And for Soundbites on Delmarva, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. On Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by the Tom Queek Foundation. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. We're engineered by Christopher Rank at Public Radio Delmarva. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For Delmarva Public Radio and on Delmarva, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.